Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Light
So
show.
we have Tamar Rosham
Correct.
here to talk today. I know that she's done a lot of different things, so I'm actually not actually sure what her
Thanks.
topic is today to talk to us about. But she's worked in many different areas of interpretability, so I'm looking forward to her presentation.
Thanks. Wait, why can't I share this one?
And so let's see here. So you're
Too many stuff.
too many PowerPoints.
Yes. Just here. Oh, it closed. Yeah, Google Slide doesn't like too many
Are you using
tabs
Google
open.
Slides to
What do
present?
you think about that?
It's adventurous.
Yeah. Just a sec, sorry. What? It's but why do I need this nice time? Okay. I know. I'm not sure if I like it actually. Great. But I guess it is depending.
Beautiful.
Great.
Works
Okay.
great.
This is actually a very first version of my job talk. So I'm on the job market this year. And I'm so glad we scheduled it for this week. Otherwise, I wouldn't do a draft version ever. And it's a very, very first version. So you'll see that like some of the slides are kind of like drafted and need to be like much more fleshy. But I'll be very happy to get your feedback about it. So that like the intro plus a disclaimer of you'll see that some of the slides are kind of like unfinished. Anything else I should mention?
Do
Yeah.
you want interruptions or just like at
I
the
think I'll
ends?
try to time it. It's probably a little bit too long. So
Let's move to the
if you can keep in mind like what part are good to like skip. I think like I have some
Is there a
idea,
timing that
but
you're going for?
I think I should do 15 minutes plus like the minutes
50?
write up. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not actually not sure. I didn't get like an explicit instruction. So
No, it's
I
not.
think the slot is like 1 hour. And yeah, so I added slide numbers so you can just write comments regarding and I'll have another later. Yeah, okay. Oh, and in some part I'll also have like some comments, especially in the intro. The intro is like not ready yet. So in some part I have comments like here I should have more example or something like that. So if you have an ideas for examples, let me. Okay, perfect. So my name is Tamar. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a postdoc with Antonio Taralba, David's X Lab. And I started to work with Antonio, but then I realized actually I wanted to do a postdoc with David. So I started to collaborate with the lab. And I'm going to present some work I did during my postdoc about how can we understand deep neural not networks and how can we automate this scientific process of deep neural network understanding. Okay, so neural networks are extremely sophisticated these days. They can generate super realistic videos. They can powered, Achilles is saying something, powered robots to do extremely crazy stuff. Of course, chatbot that can interact with us as if they were actually human being typing us messages, revealing protein structure and even predicting quantum interactions. So actually really, really crazy stuff. The problem with all these very sophisticated networks is that we don't really know what is the information encoded behind the scene. We don't know what is the algorithm operation that they are performing, although they are so good. And maybe the examples before were kind of like the trivial example that we think about when we think about very powerful AI model these days. But actually, in almost every aspect of our daily life, when we use everyday products, most of them are powered by AI models behind the scene. Whether it's like in a healthcare situation, when you get some medical recommendation, when you shop on Amazon or just watch Netflix on your TV, whatever you're doing, you are actually interacting with some AI models behind the scene. And I think it's very, very clear that we need to be able to tell something about the way that these AI models work, in order to make sure that they don't encode any harmful information or that they cannot like act in a way that we don't want them to act. But it's not only about safety and how to make these AI models safe. It's also something about controlling the behavior of them. So in something that looks like a different decade, but it was actually just a few years ago, we could design models ourselves in-house and train them with a very controlled and specific behavior. So for example, during my PhD, I trained this generative model that can generate images just from a single example. And I was able to design the architecture of that model myself. And also I was able to design a neural network that will get a state-of-the-art performance just by designing the architecture from scratch myself. And that was during my PhD. But nowadays we have these like huge pre-trained models with like billions of parameters. This is just like a single layer inside a Flex model that generates images. And it's so complicated to control the behavior of these models because they have billions of parameters. We don't really understand their architecture much, or and it's very, very hard to understand how to design them in a way that will be controllable. And that's actually the easiest part of it. Sometimes we don't really have access to the parameters of our model. Sometimes the models are black box. So if you are interacting with ChatGPT or Claude, if you're using DALL-E to generate images or Gemini, all of these models are black box. We don't know what's going on inside. So the general question I'm interested at trying to tackle, and I'm going to show you some project, some progress we made in that direction is how can we understand AI models, like the very large AI models we have nowadays, and also control their behavior, although they are very, very large, and sometimes even inaccessible to us. Okay. So I'm going to talk about three main direction, which is first trying to evaluate performance of this black box function that we have no access to their inner computations. And then I'm going to show you some ways we came up with to explain the behavior of open source models, which we can actually look inside. And then I'm going to show you how we can basically automate the process of trying to understand the behavior of deep neural networks. So let's just start. Something super cool we found around a year and a half ago is that multimodality exists in language models, even if you don't directly train for it. So what I mean about by that is if we take a language model that was trained purely on text with no multimodal pre-training, and we ask it to draw a very complicated scene, it turns out language models trained only on text can write code that will render those scenes. It's not particularly for this example. You can see a bunch of other scenes that this is GPT 3.5 generated. Yeah, fairly complex structure and relationship between object, which is really cool. Note that it actually blurred the motorcycle on the last image. And of course, you can claim that there is another modality here, which is the code. And indeed, code here kind of like serves as a mutual ground between text and the visualization. Just a little bit after we started to work on it, GPT-4 came out and the Spark of AGI paper. I don't know, you probably know that paper, but a very famous paper that kind of like claim we are just a little bit before AGI will take over. And of course, now everyone know that we can generate these visualization using pure language models. So the question we ask ourselves is, how can we quantify these visual knowledge that language model seems to have? And at least back then, that was a very challenging task because all the models that could actually generate image rendering code were black box. So we have this task of like trying to evaluate a black box. So what we did in order to answer this task is answer this question is we design a test set of tasks in order to try to evaluate the abilities of different language models. We ask language models to generate different visualization. We ask them to recognize visualization from code. We ask them, we even found that they can correct their own visualization just by looking at the code without seeing anything. And we also show that you can actually use these images in order to train a vision model for other downstream tasks. And I want to show you some examples from the drawing experiments. So for the drawing experiments, we came up with this hierarchy of concepts, starting from a single, very simple concept, like a single shape, maybe some instruction regarding the color of the shape or the arrangement of multiple shapes. And then we moved to objects that are obviously composed from multiple shapes, and then scenes that are obviously composed from multiple objects. And it turned out that a lot of different language models with no multimodal pre-training can generate this fairly complex concept, which is very cool. Another cool behavior that we found is that if you prompt a language model to generate a visualization multiple times, often you'll get a completely different visualization, which means that the model didn't kind of overfit to a particular example, but maybe it has some sort of a mental model for how, let's say, a strawberry should look like, which is also cool. And then another cool example is that sometimes you'll get an okay visualization when you try at first, but then we can basically copy paste that code and tell the model just to do better. So that was supposed to be a swivel chair. Can you please do better? And just by doing that, we can actually get fairly nicer visualizations. In fact, we showed in the paper that using our evaluation metric, inferior models like GPT-3.5, I don't know if inferior is the right word here, but maybe weaker model like GPT-3.5 can achieve the performance of GPT-4 just by doing this iteration, which is super interesting. Okay, last experiment I want to show you from this line of task is we took all these images that were generated with language models, and we trained ResNet 15 to have with a contrastive learning scheme to have some sort of like image representation. And now we take this image representation and we show that we can just train a linear layer to classify a actual images using it, and you get a really competitive result using that. So it seems like although this visualization don't look like actual images, they have a lot of information that can be useful to train an image representation. And just to visualize this representation, so we have a query image and we're trying to look at the five nearest neighbors according to the representation we train. This is if you just initialize ResNet with random weights, these are the nearest neighbor that you'll get. And this is with training the ResNet with the language model generated images. So you can see that we were actually able, just using text, to generate images that could help us train image representation that evaluate real images quite accurately, which is super cool. And if we are talking about application, we have a follow-up paper where we show that you can, instead of using an existing programming languages, we can actually design our own programming language with text that let language model or an agent powered by a language model to actually sketch in a way that looks super realistic and super human-like. So instead of taking getting this kind of like mechanistically looking visualization, we now get something that looks supernatural. Okay, so that it was about trying to evaluate performance of black box function and specifically the visual knowledge that they have. But actually, the reason I wanted to show you this project is because actually the evaluation here were kind of very intense. And the reason for that is we had to come ourselves with an interesting task to try to ask our model to solve. So we kind of like play with the model. So what could be an interesting failure mode or an interesting success mode? And we iteratively designed this protocol in order to evaluate the model. And it was very, very intense on the researcher side. And maybe a question you can ask is, maybe it's because it's a black box. Maybe if that box was open and we could look inside, maybe evaluation was easier. And that's something I also had in mind, but actually the answer is not really. It's not much easier. And I'll show you some experiment we did in order to try to understand open source model. Okay, so for trying to understand open source model, we actually went back, or not really back, but we went to kind of like a much simpler task, which is what we call entity tracking, which is the ability of language model to track information that is presented in context. The reason we do a much simpler task here is open source model are, at least back then, were kind of inferior in performance, and we could not really evaluate the ability to create visualization with them, but we wanted to evaluate something much simpler. Maybe that's not a good excuse. Tell me later, David. Okay, so yeah, back to the point. We wanted to evaluate the ability to track information that is presented in context. And specifically, we look at these data sets for entity tracking, which present a series of boxes with a series of objects located in each box. And of course, the language model should be able to say that box G contain the apple, or hopefully should be able to. Okay, now we have this open source model, so we can actually look inside at activation and weights of the model. And we want to find what is the algorithmic operation that the model performs in order to solve this task. How can we do that? We do something that is called patching in order to isolate components that are involved in the computations of the final answer. Can someone write down that I should add a citation for patching from somewhere? Great. And here is how it goes. So we start with just an input prompt to our model. If the model is successful in performing the task, looking at this prompt, it should predict the word apple. And now we store all the activation that the model had for this particular input. And now we take another input that corresponds to the same task but has a completely different information and should predict a different token, which is cat. And now we do something super cool. We look at a specific component inside the model, and we say, okay, if this model is part of the computation graph of solving this entity tracking task, then taking the activation of that model from the second forward pass, and insert it, just like copy paste it to the forward pass of the first sentence, should affect the result, meaning the result should go from apple to cup, or at least the logit of apple should go down and cup should go up. So we have this ability to kind of like score the effect of patching a specific component from one forward pass to the other with a patching score. And we can do that for each individual component in our neuron. and get something that is called the circuit, which is the subnetwork that corresponds to that specific task according to the fetching score. So all the components that got the highest are fetching score. Something super cool about this circuit when we talk about entity tracking. So we evaluated a model called Llama 7B. So it's a Llama model with 7B parameters. If you take the full model and evaluate the accuracy of the model on that task, you get accuracy of 66%. And if you just evaluate the performance of the circuit, you actually able to recover 100% of the model accuracy, which is super cool. And in fact, we do that with only 75 attention heads of the model, which are a tiny bit of the full model size. Another super cool observation we had in this point is we can actually look at other version of Llama, which are fine-tuned version, meaning someone took this model and fine-tuned it to be an expert in a specific task or on a specific data set. So for example, Vicuña is expert in kind of like user dialogues with users. And we also have Goat and Float, which are expert in arithmetic tasks with different fine-tuning scheme. And interestingly, you can see that fine-tuning on arithmetic tasks give you better performance in entity tracking. But an actual more interesting fact is we can take this circuit that we found on Llama 7B and just apply it on the fine-tuned models. And we can see that the circuit by itself kind of recover most of the performance of the fine-tuned model, meaning that the same circuit performs that task in fine-tuning models, which was kind of a surprise. When we ask ourselves, okay, maybe maybe we can say something about the mechanistic operation that or the effect that fine-tuning has on the algorithmic operation of our model. So for that, we didn't only want to look at the circuit, but we also wanted to look at the functionality that the circuit implements, so the algorithm that the circuit implements in order to perform entity tracking. So what we did is we came up with a new method called DCM, and I should have it here somewhere, probably in the title, Desiderata something, component masking something, a method, and it goes the follows. We have an original input to the model, and now instead of doing a patching experiment with some other input to the model, we design a very specific input or very specific alternation that will emphasize a specific functionality. What do I mean by that? Let's say we suspect that some components inside our model, inside our circuit, are very sensitive to the label of the box. So they're responsible for detecting the label of the correct box. We can design an alternation for the original sentence such that we basically change the query box. The question is now about a different box that actually doesn't exist in the alternation. And if we have components that are supposed to take the label of the box and associate it with the box in context, then the answer should change from document, that was the answer on the original path, to the content of box Y, which is a plot. So we design a different desiderata like that. We design an alternation that is sensitive to the object itself. So components that should bring the information about the object in the box should correspond, should have a high patching score with this alternation. And also another desiderata which correspond to the exact position of the object. So maybe some components are just looking at the exact position of the correct object and build that in. Making long story, and also we didn't want to do the exhausting patching procedure of like looking at each individual component. So instead, something super cool we did, and people are using it right now, is we train a mask that tells us where to patch. How did we do that? We kind of like approximate a binary mask over the component. So we have the IDs of the right components to patch it, And we found the mask that gives us the highest patching score in total. Okay, so we have these like different roles, different functionality, and now we can actually locate different groups of or different different groups of components that performs a very specific functionality. And to make a long story short, we found that actually the model output the correct object by transmitting the position of the correct box in context. Okay, so we have a group that kind of like summarize the information about the box we care about, and then we have a group that locate the query box, bring in the position of that box in context. We have a group that transfer this information, and finally, a group of heads that attend back to the object inside the query box. And also, very surprisingly, we found that the same functionality exists also in the fine-tune model, which performs it with enhanced abilities. So we can say that when we fine-tune a model, we don't really change the mechanism, we just enhance it, which is a very nice observation. I don't know if you can say that we were the first to say something. Can we say something like that? We were the first to show something like that?
Maybe in some detail, yeah.
Okay. And just a sneak peek, we have a follow-up paper coming soon. Maybe it will be under submission by the time I present it. We show that language models also do something that people call theory of mind, which is the ability to track different beliefs inside the concept. And actually, we show that this kind of belief tracking is very similar to entity tracking, but with additional mechanism that kind of like store information about visibility between different characters or different objects. Okay. But also here, actually, experiments were also very, very intense. And maybe we were able to kind of like semi-automate the patching experiment, but there's still a significant effort here, which was the hypothesizing part. So in order to find the functionality of different components inside the circuit, we had to like sit down and kind of hypothesize, okay, maybe some groups are very sensitive to the position. Of the object, and maybe some of them sensitive to the label of the box, and so on and so on. In fact, in the appendix of the paper, there are 3 pages full of other hypotheses we had along the way, and some results to test them. Okay. And yeah, I think we're all getting a little bit lazy, and we want someone else to do all of this for us, or at least assist that. But maybe that's not a good claim. Maybe what I should say here is that actually models are so large right now. So that was Llama 7b. And I think today's Llama 7b is like the tiniest model that exists. We have Llama 4 or 5b, which is far way larger and performs much more difficult operations. And doing this like manual experiment and manual hypothesis generation part is very, very exhausting. So maybe there's a way to automate that. Maybe we can do something to automate this scientific process of trying to hypothesize and test hypotheses regarding the behavior of an underlying model we care about. This is not an issue only with like patching experiment or only with understanding language model. It's a general issue when we're trying to explain neural networks. And we actually have really good tools nowadays to try to investigate either inner representation or trying to get like this saliency map of where the model pay attention to, visualize some like weights or kernels inside our model, and even finding these circuits. We have great tools, but if we want to be able to say something about the operation of the model as a whole, not only on a specific task, but like in general, we need to be able to integrate these tools and to do a lot of experiment to validate different hypotheses. And I think I'll skip this slide. So I want to show you the effort we need in order to try to automate the process of explaining a neural network. And there have been attempts to automate this like explanation procedure, and I want to start show you some one example trying to explain an image classifier. So let's say I have this image, I input it to a classifier, I get a suit class for that specific image. And now I want to understand why that this image was recognized as a suit. So maybe there is a specific neuron that fires for that particular image, and maybe that neuron is sensitive to the concept of a suit. So I can look at that neuron, I can take the activation that it has. Maybe that neuron got the highest activation along all the other neurons in the classifier. And I can also look at the area where the activation was high inside the image. In fact, we can do this process not for a single image, but for a very large data set of images like ImageNet, and look at all the images that got these top activations. This process is called network dissection, by the way. And we can see that this kind of like gives us a visual explanation of the sensitivity of the neuron. But if we actually want kind of a label for the neuron, maybe we will need to ask human labelers to look at these images and say, oh, it seems like all the common stuff that we have here is maybe the lower part of human faces, or maybe some sort of a neckwear. So we can see that this is still very labor intensive. We still need a lot of, but we still need human to help us here. So what people have done in order to automate this process is to train a sort of like captionnaire that look at this set of explanation and give a specific label for them. So that's something people did in a paper called Milan, in a method called Milan, a paper from ICLR 22. And Milan look at these images and say, okay, these images correspond to human and animal faces. Maybe that's very bad, but actually with Milan, we only get to hypothesize once about the behavior of the network, the neuron, and we never actually get to validate the hypothesis we generated. And now if we want to use this information for a downstream task, for example, I want to control the behavior of the classifier such that it will never classify human faces, then I'll actually need to validate that conclusion first. And the second thing is, Milan can only help us with a specific task, which is neuron labeling. But actually, you can think about interpretability as a broad set of tasks that you can, a broad set of explanation that you want to get about your model. And Milan doesn't help us with other type of question we might have. Okay, so what I want to show you now is how to actually automate the scientific process of trying to explain an arbitrary behavior of a neural network. So imagine that you maybe have some sort of an agent that can interact with your neural network. And giving a specific question about the behavior of the network, it can generate multiple hypotheses regarding the behavior, and then generate actual input to the network that will test different type of different aspect of these hypotheses. We'll get the output of these, and then according to the output, we'll update the hypothesis that it has, and so on and so on, and until it can actually conclude something smart about the behavior of the model. And we want this agent to be able to explore any type of model that we have and to answer any sort of interpretability question that we have about the behavior of the model. Okay, so this is exactly what we did in, or at least a first attempt, a first version of it in our last ICML paper when we introduced the multimodal automated interpretability agent, or MIA in short. And I want to show you how we can build such an agent and how can we use it to understand vision models. Okay, so can we actually build an agent that will help us with exploring neural network? The first thing we did is we took GPT-4V and we powered it with a Python library that enables to interact with actual neurons inside vision models. So if we have a specific neuron we care about in a particular network, let's say we have unit zero in layer four of ResNet 152, and at some point, maybe the agent has the hypothesis that this neuron is sensitive to airplanes. Using that Python library, it can look at the activation value and the activation map of that neuron on a specific image, let's say an image of an airplane. So the agent can actually interact with neuron inside actual vision model. Another side of the system is tools that enable Maya to design experiments. So let's say Maya hypothesized that a specific neuron is sensitive to airplanes in general. It needs to get the input data from somewhere. So the first tool that we implemented is this dataset exemplars tools, which enables to call a very large dataset, a fixed dataset of images, and to get activation values on that dataset. Another tools we have is to enable Maya to actually generate more test cases. So we have a text-to-image tool that enables Maya to generate new images, let's say a new image of an airplane, and also edit these images to actually test the causal effect of changing some aspect in the input image. So maybe that neuron is not sensitive to airplane in general, but only airplanes in daylight and not during the night. We also have tools that enable us to do the other way around, so summarize images into text. And we have an experiment log where Maya can actually choose to log in the result from the experiment so that they will be available for the next iteration. Of course, Maya cannot actually run Python code, but we design something that looks like a Python library in the system prompt as text for Maya. So Maya gets all these tools as text. And now we can actually extract the code that Maya writes, and run it for it, and automatically input the result of the experiment. Okay, so we have that system that can interact with actual vision models, has plenty of tools to design experiment to understand vision models. And now a user can just come and prompt the system with a specific specific question that it has regarding the model. For example, what is the functionality of unit 122 in a particular model? And something super interesting is starting to happen when we are doing that. Maya actually autonomously design and conduct experiment to answer the question. So it make a hypothesis, it design experiment to test the hypothesis, it refines the hypothesis according to the observed outcomes, and so on and so on until it can answer that question. And because we didn't design this system to answer this particular question, a user can now come and ask a different question, for example, about a failure mode that it observed with the model. And Maya can, again, design an experiment to answer that question. So let's see one example for how Maya operates. So again, we are looking at the task of explaining a particular neuron inside the model. And when we prompt Maya to do that, it usually starts with calling the dataset exemplars tool, which it's a very intuitive thing to do, although we didn't instruct it to do that, because then you get a sort of a prototypical behavior of the neuron on a very large dataset of images. So this is the output of calling dataset exemplars. You look at the images that got the highest activation. Do you have a guess for what's going on here? Like, what is the sensitivity? By the way, it's the same neuron that we saw before with Milan. Okay.
Looks like the bow tie.
Oh no, David.
Is
you
it?
You cannot reveal the answer.
Isn't it? Do I already know this?
Yes. Probably. Otherwise, no. I think people usually say lower part of the face for some reason. I think that was also my first reaction, actually. Okay, and Maya, look at these images, or maybe before. And this is basically where Milan stopped. Right? It look at the dataset exemplars, summarize something about them, and that's it. But Maya can continue iteratively. So it looks at the output and say, okay, there might be a possible explanation here. Maybe it's sensitive to some facial feature. Maybe it's sensitive to neckwear, particularly bow ties, and maybe it has to do something with also formal clothing. So we design more experiment to validate these hypotheses, and particularly for the bow tie hypothesis, it uses the text to image tool with prompts that generate images of bow ties in different contexts. For example, many people wearing bow ties, or bow ties with no one wearing them, just on the table, a dog wearing a bow tie and a kid wearing a bow tie. And for all of this, it gets the activation values and the area in the image where the activation was high. It also uses the image to text tool to summarize the context, the content inside the mask area. So it looks at the result of this experiment and say, okay, based on the experiment to test the bow tie hypothesis, it does seem like the neuron responds specifically for bow ties. And now it has a refinement for the hypothesis. So it wants to check that it's sensitive to bow ties regardless of the context of where they presented. Maybe it's sensitive to bow ties more when it combines with formal attire. And also, let's just validate that there's no response to other type of neckwear. And now it does something super cool. So it generates images and then edit them to test some causal effects. So generate an image of a person with no bow tie, and then edit the image to introduce a bow tie to that person. And you can see how the activation suddenly goes up, and also we can see that the neuron activates around the bow ties itself. And it does that for multiple images. So for example, you generate an image of a person wearing a bow tie and then replace the bow tie with a scarf. You can see how the activation goes down. It has a person wearing a bow tie with a hoodie, and then it replaced a hoodie with the a formal shirt, and you can see how the activation goes slightly up, and so on and so on. Looks at the result and say, okay, it seems like indeed this is the bow tie detector neuron. And it seems like there is a higher sensitivity when bow ties are worn with formal attire. Super cool, right? And this is the neuron we saw before. And Milan caption for that neuron was human and animal faces, which is not bad. But according to the signals we see here, we can definitely tell that bow ties is much more accurate. And I'll also show you how we actually evaluated the labels from both Milan and Maya. Okay, so that was a kind of like a simplified version of the experiment. Now I want to show you the actual code that Maya writes. And what's really nice about the code is Maya documents it so well, so you can actually know what was the reason it chose us to use any of the tools. Okay, so again, it started with the dataset exemplars. And here you can actually see the explanation, which is nice. And these are the images that got the top activations for the particular neuron that we are looking at. Any guess now? You can guess it.
Am I allowed to guess?
Yeah, you are.
Circular object.
Spherical
object.
Spherical objects, great.
Balls. Yeah.
Balls. Something else? Cool. Maya noticed that it's not only spherical objects, it also has something to do with
Oh.
pens.
Oh. Yeah, you like that, right? Yes.
Okay, so we have spherical object and hands as the hypothesis, and now it does something super cool. So we generate an image of a person holding a banana and a person holding a cube. These images do not activate the neuron because they have no spherical object, and then it edits the images to have spherical objects instead of the banana and the cube. These are the results. Now suddenly the neuron fires, and we see some higher activation and activation map. So Maya concludes that this is the hands interacting with spherical object neuron. And our question you can ask is, how the hell do we know that this is true? So what I didn't tell you about this neuron is that this is actually a synthetic neuron that we designed to have a specific behavior. And the behavior we instruct it to have is this is new, to be sensitive to balls, but only in the presence of hands in the image. Actually, the challenging part here in general was the evaluation. And synthetic neurons actually really helped us evaluating the performance of Maya, but we also have a protocol for evaluating actual neurons in vision models. I need to find a better word for actual neurons, because I presented this for a neuroscience group. And when I said actual neurons, they were so excited. They were sure I'm going to show them.
Took some brains.
Yes. So I need to it's like actual artificial neurons or something like that. But yeah, anyway. So we had synthetic neurons that actually, that really helps us evaluate performance of interpretability agents. We actually have a full paper just about that, how to design synthetic neurons with very specific behaviors. I think I'll want to skip this part, but just say that we have this data set and a benchmark to evaluate automated interpretability protocol. For this particular paper, we designed synthetic vision neurons. And the way we did that is we took rounded SAM, which is a segmentation algorithm that is instructed by text. So we instructed SAM to segment balls and hands. And now when it gets this image, we did a little bit of other tweaks to make it look like an actual activation function, activation mask of a neuron. And this is what we get. We have several types of synthetic neurons, monosemantic neurons that are sensitive to one concept, polysemantic neurons that are sensitive to multiple concepts. The concepts can be completely unrelated. And also conditional neurons that are sensitive to one object, but only in the presence of the other one. Now, in order to make this evaluation super interesting, something we did is, other than just comparing Maya to other state-of-the-art neuron labeling methods like Milan, we also replaced Maya with actual researchers, because the end goal of this is to see that explanation by Maya are actually equivalent to explanations by researchers. So we gave researchers the same API as Maya have, the same way to interact with models and design experiments, and we asked them to solve the same exact task as a baseline for Maya. And now, because we have these synthetic neurons with known behavior, we can compare explanation from Maya and explanation from other baselines like Milan or the human labelers. And this is the result we got when we ask people to actually rate explanation from different baselines. So what we see here is the preference rate that people gave to explanation by method A versus method B. So we can see that in 73% of the cases, people preferred Maya explanation over Milan, and also Maya explanation are kind of comparable with human explanation. People prefer them in 53% of the time. So 50% will be completely random here. Oof, I don't have time. Okay, sometimes Maya can be super funny. So here's, oh, no, it's not that. Okay, maybe I'll skip this part. Let me know what you think. Okay, but of course, synthetic neurons are cool, but we actually care about real neurons in vision models. So here's an example of an actual neuron inside a vision model. This is neuron 533 in layer 4 of ResNet. And again, Maya start with dataset exemplars. Look at these exemplars and say that there are multiple hypotheses. One is that this is a neuron that is sensitive to tennis ball, maybe round objects in general. Maybe object with fuzzy textures, and maybe it has something to do with the color yellow or the specific color tone of this object. So we designed an experiment to test each of these hypotheses. And you can see that only the image that had the tennis ball activated the neuron. So a ball doesn't activate, a fuzzy texture doesn't activate, and the color yellow doesn't activate. And Maya sees that and just want to validate that there is an equal sensitivity to tennis ball in different contexts. And this is what it does here. So we designed another experiment when tennis ball are presented in different scenarios, on the road, on the water, in the snow, and so on and so on. And for all of them, there is a high activation for the tennis ball. So the conclusion is This is the tennis ball mirror. Sometimes Maya can be super funny. So this is in the middle of an experimentation to explain a feature inside, a unit inside Dino Vision Transformer. So at this point, Maya hypothesized that this unit is sensitive to faces of birds. It designed an experiment to test that. So it generates two images of birds. And this is the activation value and the activation mask of those images. And now it does a very funny edit where it asks to change the head of the bird and the head of, the head of the birds to a head of a dog and a head of a cat. This is the result. Just zooming in so you can appreciate. And these images don't really activate the neuron. I think the reason that the cat one still activates is because something that looks like the beak remains here. And look, it looked at it at these and concluded there is some sensitivity to head of birds. Here's another funny example. So this is for a neuron inside a clip vision encoder. At some point, Maya suspects that the neuron is sensitive to different angle of faces. So it generates an image of a family photo. And it seems like the neuron activates on the leg area, but for some reason, Maya doesn't care. And then it uses the following editing instruction, flip the family photo upside down. And at this point, I was really hoping that it will just like import OpenCV or something like that, rotate the image, right? Like that's like what we would do, but it didn't. It called the editing tool in order to rotate the image, and the result is not that good. There's no activation. And then the conclusion is kind of like noisy. And this is something that we see. So most of the failures that we see with Maya is because of tools shortcomings. So sometimes tools just over edit the image or don't pay attention to negative instructions. So kind of like emphasize something that we actually don't want to have. But this is actually an interesting point because it means that as long as the tools that we are using will keep improving, so does the result by Maya. And we actually show that in an ablation study we have in the paper. Okay. I promised you that I'll also show you the way we evaluated neuron inside vision models. And the way we did it is by some sort of a predictive evaluation. So if we have a label from Maya, how well could we predict the activation values of images that Maya didn't see? So for that, we did the following. We took the label from Maya, and we instruct a language model to generate image prompts that, according to the label, should either activate the neuron or not activate the neuron. So we have these like positive exemplars and kind of like neutral exemplars that should not fire. And then we actually generate the images. And if the label from Maya is accurate, then the positive exemplars should correspond to images that has on average high activation value, and the neutral one should have low activation value. In order to make this even more challenging, we use additional step, which is to generate a very challenging data set of image prompts. And the reason we did that is we wanted to combine all possible positive and negative exemplars from also the competitive method. So we will actually have a very challenging destructors in the data set. So we don't just like generate the images according to one label, but we generate them according to all the labels we compare and according to this like large data set of prompts. And now we can actually compare all these methods. So we have a label from Milan, we can get the average value of the positive exemplars and neutral exemplars. And we can also do that for the human labels. This is the result. So plus is for the average activation of a positive exemplars, the positive exemplars, minus is for the neutral, We have melanin purple, Maya hour method in turquoise, and human labels in green. And we also evaluated three different models, ResNet, Dyno, CLIP, and of course the synthetic neurons also here. You can see that almost in all the cases, or actually in all the cases, Maya outperformed Milan's, and also in most cases, it is on par with the human labels, which is what we wanted. Okay, and now to the cool part. So as I told you at the beginning of this part, we didn't design Maya to answer a specific question about the model, and now we can actually prompt it to try to explain different behavior, different interpretability tasks. So one thing we did is to use Maya to identify biases in a classifier. So now instead of looking at neuron inside the model, we actually look at the model prediction, at the probability that the model give to a specific image. So here's an example for a procedure like that. We prompted Maya with the question of, are there biases in the Beer-Glass class of images? And Maya just started to hypothesize regarding different biases that the classifier could have. So we'd want to check social bias, and maybe some bias to if the Beer-Glass is presented in some unusual scenario. It wants to check some gender bias, and also sensitivity to the type of the Beer-Glass. So here's the experimented design. It's kind of long, but you can see that for each hypothesis, it actually generated multiple images that should correspond to that hypothesis. And these are the results. So these are the results for the social bias. You can see that the same activation exists whether the Beer-Glass is in social context or is not. Different scenarios, so like on an office table or in a sink, these are still fairly activating the classifier. This is for the gender bias. And this is for the different type of Beer-Glasses. And at this point, Maya kind of noticed that there is some sort of gender bias, maybe, because if I go back, you can see that images of the Beer-Glass held by a woman get lower activation, lower probability, comparing to a man holding the Beer-Glass. So we designed more experiment to test that, as well as other. Experiment to test sensitivity to different type of Beer-Glasses, because there as well we saw some variation. Here are the results for testing gender bias. Here are the results for testing sensitivity to different glass type. Look at them and conclude that there is some gender bias in ImageNet Beer-Glass classifier, which as far as we know was not revealed before. So we actually revealed a new super important bias that exists in a ResNet classifier. Another biases that we were able to reveal this way is that the Labrador class is actually sensitive to bright Labrador over dark fur Labrador. The suit class is sensitive to dark suits and not so to other colors. This is a funny bias. So this is the tench fish class, which is the very first class of ImageNet. If you open the data set, you'll see that it's not actually a tench fish, but fishermen's holding the tench fish. And I was kind of surprised that these are the images that ImageNet collected for tenches. But then we went to Vienna for ICML, and we actually went to fish some tenches. Or try to, but we actually weren't able to catch anything. And the guy that we guided that we took told us that it's very rare to catch a tench fish. And then like I realized that it's so rare you cannot really take a picture of a tench like in like just like swimming around. And when people actually get a tench, they are so happy, so they take a picture of it. So that's the reason there is a class in ImageNet for fishermen holding tench fish. Sometimes Maya will conduct experiment but won't find any bias, which is also nice. So sometimes it will actually conclude that I did a bunch of experiments. It doesn't seem like there is any bias toward any specific setting, which is what happened in this flagpole class. Okay, last application is for removing a sparse correlation from a network. So sometimes you will train a network on your training set, and then you'll come to like actually test it in real scenarios, and it won't perform as well as in the lab. And our possible reason for that is that the training set contains some correlation between features that you don't really meant to have, you don't really aware of. So we mimic that behavior with training a classifier or on a dataset that is called the spurious dataset, which is for dog breed classification, but each dog is spuriously correlated with a specific background. So for example, Corgi will be always presented in a snowy environment. And then we train a ResNet model on that dataset to force that test dataset has a random background for each dog breed. And now because of that, the test accuracy of that model is not so good, only 73%, because the model kind of like learned to look at sparse features that does not exist in the test phase. So what we did is we tasked Maya with finding neurons inside the classifier that we train that are not sensitive to the dog breed, but something else. So we only want to find to being able to locate neurons that are sensitive only for the dog breed. And here are some examples for experiment Maya ran. So again, it starts with the dataset exemplars. The dataset exemplars are from the biased dataset. It doesn't have any access to unbiased data. Seems like this neuron is sensitive to a specific dog breed, right? So not so. When Maya generated more images of other dog breed in the jungle environment, it was able to reveal that there's actually some sensitivity to the background, and it labeled this neuron as spurious. And then in another case, it generated images of other dog breed in the snow environment and the same dog breed, but in different environment. And it seems like these all are sensitive only for that particular dog breed, and it marked this neuron as selective. And now what we did is, oh, and actually it only marked 22 neurons out of the 500 that it tested as selective, which is super cool. So now what we did is, instead of using the full original model that got accuracy of 73%, we fine-tuned the last linear layer of the classifier, but with the biased data, only on the 22 neuron that Maya found to be spurious. And you can see how the accuracy is now much higher. In fact, it is almost as high as just fine-tune your model on the unbiased data, which is super cool. So we were able to actually enhance the model performance according to the result we got from Maya.
So for the Maya case, what was the experiment exactly? So you knocked out all the other units other than the 22, or what is it that you did?
So these 22 neurons are from the last layer, just before the linear layer. So what we did is we fine-tuned the linear layer to take only these 22 neurons.
You fine-tuned it, and on what data?
On the
original training
yes,
set.
Yes, on the biased training set.
Excellent.
Yeah. If you do the same with the same 22 neuron on the unbiased data set, you get
a little bit better.
Yes, a little bit better.
But only a little.
Yeah. Okay, this is about Maya. We have a full experiment browser in our website where you can actually look at all the experiment what Maya performs along with the implementation it had and the final conclusion. And I think the conclusion of this part is AI models are so good now that we can actually build AI agents that will help us with AI tools that will help us understand other AI models. And I think in all, or maybe I'll say it later. Okay, I have some text here. We have a new version of Maya coming out soon with improved tools and improved reasoning abilities. So stay tuned for that. We also have a new benchmark for bias detection coming out in the next month. And we have an ongoing project to reveal more global behavior of models. So not behaviors that are corresponding to a particular nuance, but maybe like global subnetworks in your model, like the circuits we saw in the other paper. Okay. Regarding future works, and here I'm not fully sure what to say yet, but what we saw along this presentation that we have some very powerful tools to investigate language model and also well-known methods to investigate vision models. But I think the world is now going to a direction where everything is going to be multimodal, and we should be able to have a unified approach to test language behavior, vision behavior, interaction between language and vision, and also other type of signals like audio, and maybe stuff that we don't really imagine right now because the future models will take different kind of inputs. So as a general goal, I intend to have universal interpretability approaches that will combine universal interpretability tools with interpretability agents that will be able to interact with any sort of model that we want. And I think a promise with interpretability agent is they are not only capable with assisting researchers like us, but maybe also able to assist some end users. So imagine that your grandmother is having a problem with her iPhone sitting home. Maybe we could have some sort of interpretability chatbot that will help her actually understand why the iPhone is not working today. And if we have these universal tools that will enable us to conduct experiment to explain very complex AI models and agents that can design experiment to answer some hypothesize and answer a question about models, maybe we can apply these kind of approaches not only for AI models, but for other scientific domains. And this is something I'm looking forward to try. In fact, I just started a collaboration with a project called Enigma in Stanford, which are actually scanning brains of alive animals in order to map them. And they're interested in using similar approaches to the automated interpretability in order to design experiments on their domain. And I think that's it. Yeah, that's it. They started at... I think it was 1 hour and 5 minutes or something.
Yeah, I took out the 2 minutes that you had talking with David about that question.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like 1 hour and 3 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
Questions for the talk on the subject matter first?
I have a list of questions. Should I do it one by one or do you want like...
I don't know. How do you usually do it?
Maybe just start.
Maybe we can start from the beginning and then do it.
Okay.
Or is it like question about the...
No, just questions about the material.
Oh, okay.
Before,
okay. Yeah,
before we give you...
Yeah.
Before we
yes.
Give you
great, great, great. Yeah, question.
You at slide 24, you mentioned these models are not trained for multimodal retraining. Do you think they've been trained on codes like that? If so, would you consider that multimodal?
Good question. I think they definitely been trained on code like that for visualization, but they didn't see the output of the code. So I think that's the like important. So they know that like the here's the example of like something that should generate something, but they never actually saw the visualization itself.
Right.
But are there like comments in the code that say like, here's what this text or this code will generate?
Yeah. Probably yes. Something that we like, we definitely know that is they're really good at like documenting code. Like if there is one thing that they are doing very well is documenting code. So I'm pretty sure that like they have a lot of information regarding like what should represent what from comments.
So it seems like most of the spatial reasoning is coming from the vector arithmetic, right? Like, at pixel 12, I would put a sheep.
Yes.
Maybe the next sheep should come at like pixel 18 so that there's no overlap. So do you think the models that are, you had a glob model or something, arithmetic trained Llama 7B fine tuned. Do you think such models would do better at this
task? Oh, you mean like fine tuned arithmetic will help them with like special reasoning? That's a cool question. Because it's like, yeah, maybe, yeah, maybe it's like it's like a 2D position formation. Yeah, that's a great question. So we have that paper of entity tracking, like how to track information. We actually have an undergrad student in the lab that is trying to do, I only now realize that it's something similar, but like kind of like special reasoning in VLMs. So how do we know that something is next to something? And maybe we can try to fine tune the VLM on like arithmetic and see if it improves like special reasoning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the way down to like the Maya paper, maybe I missed it, but I wasn't sure. Like, how does, I guess, it work when, like, it doesn't identify what concept is there in the neuron? Like, I guess the edge case of like,
interpretable neuron. Yeah. Sometimes it will say, like, this is very general, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should give an example like that. That's a good point. Sometimes it will just keep exploring. Something we added is after like 20 iteration or something like that, if it's not like ready to conclude, we just ask it to conclude whatever. So right now we don't have a limit. It can do, like, we don't say, okay, after 5 iteration, please conclude. We just give it like to run. But we, at some point we do ask it to just conclude. And something interesting that we found is sometimes if it wasn't able to get any interesting signal at that last iteration, it will just call dataset exemplar and conclude.
Yeah.
There's a plot for your test time compute, GPT 3.5 versus 4. Like the more number of times you ask it to get better.
Yes.
And it's interesting that GPT 3.5 does better as it goes, but GPT 4 is like almost flat.
Where is it? Isn't that like I heard speculation that GPT 4 was just like a multi GPT 3.5 doing like majority voting or something like that. So that's like a kind of like an evidence for that.
I mean, is it possible to do much better? Is it just saturated?
I think it's already like, so the evaluation metric here is some sort of like clip classification. So like 99% of the time you got it right. So it's already kind of saturated. Like
started. Already.
Maybe you need a harder task.
Yeah. We also wanted to do it with more complicated images. So not only with the object, but also with scenes. And I think we ran out of budget or something. Like these experiments were like very expensive because, or at least back then, I think with these models today, it might be cheaper. But yeah, maybe with more complicated scene, we will see separation. I'm kind of bothered by how not smooth it is. So like maybe it has something with the fact that like we only had like 100 concepts which we reiterated, or like I just, for example, I don't understand the deep in like iteration 2 or 3.
Is the prompt simply can you do better, or
it's something like that was supposed to be a swivel chair, can you do better? Yeah.
So a little bit sarcastic.
Yeah. Mm, I don't know. I didn't make it mini to either. But it sounds sarcastic.
A question for the Maya agent part. So I did a lot eyeballing manual screening, looking for those features. So I guess my impression is in early layers, there are a lot of integrable low-level features like color, texture. And in some later layers, also there are a lot of integrable features like parts of objects or objects itself. But what bugs me is in like those middle layers, sometimes it's really hard to find some integrable features. I don't know if you have the same impression.
It really depends on the model, I guess. Actually, in I think in CLIP we saw a lot of interesting stuff also in the middle. So kind of like text and vision, like mutual. Like for example, I remember a Spider-Man neuron that is corresponding not only for visuals of Spider-Mans, but also for like strong. What else? Like comical, like
words
and titles and or like conjunction. I can remember like ampersand and the word end. I think those were actually in the middle. Another interesting point is we actually have it in the appendix of the paper. Maya was more successful in labeling middle and layer neurons than the very early neurons, because it wasn't that good at like just thinking about very low level concept like the color red. And it's just basically because of the field, like the vision or like the way it was trained for like image captioning.
Right.
So it doesn't pay attention for like texture and stuff like that so much. I do think that it is possible to fine tune a VLM to pay attention to low level details more. And in fact, this is something that I should probably put in the conclusion of the talk somehow. I feel like, we showed in the paper that we can get performance that are on par with human researchers. But I think something interesting to, like an interesting goal will be getting something which is better than human researcher, especially if we want to use this agent for scientific discovery. And I think this will be like super challenging. Because in the project we have right now for having an agent for bias detection, we actually found out that all these agents or these models are biased themselves to just factual knowledge. And if we have, like, we design a synthetic system that is sensitive to a tie, but only when a woman wear it. And they really have hard time to detect that because it's so out of distribution for them. So I think if we want something that will be, I think it's just like a mirror of what we would say, like these models. And if you want something that will perform better than us, I think it will take hard work. Yeah.
So in my online work, basically you have this kind of text to image and image to text, and kind of there's an assumption prior that the interpretive features should be describable by words in some sense.
Oh,
like
right.
In the final slide, I see your collaborations in Enigma project and was like doing those type of things. So now, many things you synthesize from monkeys or mice neurons are kind of, you know,
yes.
Not, I mean, they don't know language or English. So I don't have to by the prior that they should be describable by words.
Yeah.
So do you have?
I think that's a really good point. I think right now we are using language as our hypothesis generation medium just because language models are so strong. But we should definitely consider other type of hypothesis representation. Maybe like even like, I don't know, differentiable equation or maybe images could be like hypothesis. So yeah, definitely. I don't think language are necessarily necessarily the only way to describe behaviors of neurons. Yeah.
I had a question on your synthetic neurons for Maya. Like I was trying to find in the paper like a split between the kinds, so like monosemantic, polysemantic, of like how well the model did for different
Oh,
kinds.
we don't have it in the paper?
I didn't see one, but
Yeah, you're right.
I'm just curious if you
Yeah,
can.
you're right. That's an interesting thought. Yeah.
Because like it seems like if you just like pick two random concepts and expect the model to be able to pick them out, unless you're like data set exemplars is like very broad, it'd
Yeah.
be hard to do something like that.
Yeah. I vaguely remember that we did have.
Like I would guess probably the order of easiness would be like monosemantic, polysemantic, and conditional
Yes.
or
Yes, I agree with your intuition. We, in fact, we also had another type of nuance, which was the opposite of conditional. So like dog, but only if there's no leash. And those were the hardest. The fact that we didn't include it in the paper was only because the synthetic neurons themselves didn't like weren't working that well. So they weren't like as reliable as
gotcha.
the others. But let me check for the separation. I think it's important, yeah.
Sure, for the Maya line work. So the agent basically you just need to design the workflow and prompt it to do so, and no need to do any fine-tuning or stuff.
Right,
Okay.
right. So you design the API, which are basically the tools that you want it to enable it to use. Yeah, and then you prompt it. The hard part was, so once we had the library design as like an actual Python library, it started to use it like immediately with no problem. And then also like explaining the task was relatively easy. The problem was actually with like the formatting. So we wanted to reliably output the code in a specific format. So we make sure we can always like parse it out, run it. So that was like we did a little bit of prompt engineering there. But the like actual contribution was setting the tools as a Python library. But I think now you actually have. Maybe at least with Claude, you have the ability to define tools and like in the API. So I think like you should be able to do it built in now.
You had
Wait, I
a
had a
table
question.
for the circuit work where
Yeah,
you
the
said.
circuit work need some adjustment, I feel like. Table.
Yeah, the circuit, yeah, the sec, yeah. What does it, what did you actually do for the circuit column? Is it just using the circuit
It's
neurons?
just like applying the identity of neurons from the circuit we found in Llama. Just evaluate that circuit on the other models. We didn't redo the patching experiment to find the circuit in the other
So
models.
this
So
is with
it's
all other attention heads set to zero, right?
a oh, in mean ablation, yeah.
Yeah.
I see. So just the attention's ablated to mean, or is it the MLPs and
It's all the MLPs, if I remember
I
correctly.
don't remember.
Yeah, it's all the MLPs. But Nikhil is probably here somewhere, so we can also comment. But it's all the MLPs, but just the attention heads.
No, it was not them.
You mean the MLPs were not ablated? The MLPs are included, right? And but then you ablate the attention heads and are not.
All the attention. All the attention heads were knocked out, which were not part of the second.
Oh yeah, so also on the table, did you also look at like because the circuit accuracy increases for GOAT and float. Did you also look at maybe faithfulness and
Yeah, we did look at other matrices that I didn't wanted to include here. They didn't want to, yeah. But we did. We have it all in the paper. In fact, the way we found the Llama circuit, okay, so when you do like we did path patching there. But when you do like a patching experiment, you get a patching score. You don't really have a threshold of like what is the amount of features to include. So we optimize the circuit size according to some minimality criterion.
Right. I also wonder if you happen to run like the arith if you use the cert the circuit found in Llama on the arithmetic task, what would happen to the like how would the model perform like using the entity tracking circuit on the arithmetic?
Oh.
And maybe there might be some overlaps in the circuit components.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I feel like this type of like more general model behavior of like how the circuit, what is the components that are doing entity tracking versus components that are doing arithmetic. I think those are exactly the question we want to ask with agents on language models. So imagine, and this is something we're trying to do now, it's actually very hard, but imagine that you have an agent that will be able to find like multiple circuit and say something about the intersection between them and like what sort of knowledge in sort is sorted where, but not according to like one or two tasks, according to like millions, not millions, but hundreds of tasks. Yeah, I think that's exactly the reason we need a way to automate these experiments.
Is it the next step for Maya?
Yes, it's an ongoing project. But like if someone wants to join us with that, I think we all the people are like super busy and we are not making a good progress. So we will be happy to have someone enthusiasm, like with enthusiasm to help us. Yeah.
Have you thought about doing something like the like O1 style? Like you can create synthetic neurons. It's kind of
Like
train on those. Like you have a ground truth, and so you can do RL on.
oh, in the sense of like evaluation or in the sense of
In the sense of training Maya.
so training Maya to be multi-step. So in some sense, okay. In some sense, Maya does do some sort of a multi-step reasoning, I guess. But like interactively with the model and not like interactively but like between like multiple agents, which I believe that is what O1 does.
Well, yeah, so I don't know what O1 does, but I guess the theory is like if you have some sort of verifiable output, you want to be able to sort of provide feedback on
Oh,
each
I
of those
see, I see, I
steps
see.
so that they're
I
more
see. Oh, I
intelligent.
see. Okay, yeah. If you have the ground truth, like what should be the result, you can provide some feedback and do RL on
Right,
that.
right.
And then
So.
train Maya too. Yeah. No, I didn't think about that. That's an interesting idea.
So I think like OpenAI has a like reinforcement fine-tuning API now for like
Oh, okay.
humans. You can just do that.
And see if like we get a model that is just like a better Maya. Yeah. Cool. That sounds like a port, like an undergrad project or something. Yeah, that can be like we can try that.
That's great. Now,
Wait, I had one question. So
oh, okay, one more.
before
Okay,
we get,
Nikhil, before we go into other
yeah,
comments.
so yeah, can you go to the last slide?
Last slide.
Yeah. So, yeah, can you talk about what do you mean by universal interpretability tools? Do you think the existing ones are like limited to a specific modality?
Kind of, yeah. I think that maybe people are now starting to talk about patching also for vision models, but like vision people are talking in a completely different language when they're trying to understand. Why is that fine? They're trying to understand some sort of operation. And I think both in like if we want to advance the technology or like advance our way to interpret models, but also in the sense of like building an interpretability community. I don't think it has to be like that. I think we need to come up with like a unified language to talk about these models. And I think everything is going to be multimodal like in a few years. So there's also no reason to keep it separated.
Okay.
What do you think, Nikhil?
I mean, in terms of the community wise, yeah. I mean, I don't really know about the vision community, so I can't really say about that. But in terms of the actual tools, I mean, as long as we have vectors in the model, I think we should be able to use existing tools that we have. That's why I wasn't clear about that.
Yeah. Okay, maybe universal is not.
Yeah, but this is my thought. I'm not 100% sure about it either.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe more automatic in general. Like you have Maya, but then like I guess there are different ways, like ways you can make it more automatic.
Oh,
so like automatic.
I think it's more about unifying approaches rather than automating them.
Multimodal or cross-modal?
Maybe cross-modality, yeah. Multimodal, yeah.
Interpretability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
You know, I think that what it'd be cool if, and so, you know, so thanks, Tamar. And then you're looking for feedback just on the talk structure,
yes,
in general, right?
Yes, and I need to.
If people want to hang around and,
yes,
give tomorrow like talk feedback, then we can brainstorm on that. I'm gonna stop recording here.